like white caps on a choppy sea. There were no trees, no shade, no parks or football fields or rivers. Just a sea of tents and a forest of electric poles and wires.
"Hey, we're in luck," Mahmoud's dad joked. "The circus is in town."
Mahmoud looked around. There was a main street in the camp, a wide lane where refugees had set up little shops, selling phone cards and camp stoves and clothes and things people had brought with them but no longer wanted or needed. It was like a giant rummage sale, and it seemed like everybody in the camp was there. The path was crammed full of Syrians, all strolling along like they had nothing else to do and nowhere else to go.
"All right," Mahmoud's father was saying. "A man in the group we walked with gave me the name of a smuggler who can get us from Turkey to Greece."
"A smuggler?" Mom said.
Mahmoud didn't like the sound of that either. To him, smuggler meant illegal, and illegal meant dangerous. Dad waved their fears away.
"It's fine. This is what they do. They get people into the EU.
The EU, Mahmoud knew, was the European Union. He also knew they were much more strict about letting people in than Turkey was. Once you were in one of the EU countries, though, like Greece or Hungary or Germany, you could apply for asylum and be granted official refugee status. It was getting there that was the hard part.
"I've been talking to him on WhatsApp," Dad continued, holding up his phone. "It will be expensive, but we can pay. And we'll have to get to Izmir on the Turkish coast. Assuming we stop to sleep every night, that's a 19-day walk. Or it's a 12-hour car ride non-stop. I'll see if I can find us a bus."
Mahmoud and his mother and sister and brother walked the shopping street. People called out to one another in Arabic, and music from radios and TVs filled the air. Other children darted in and out among the adults, laughing and chasing each other into the alleys of tents off the main drag. Mahmoud caught himself smiling. After Aleppo, the near-constant gunfire and explosions, punctuated by the oppressive quiet of an entire city trying their hardest not to draw attention to themselves, this place felt alive, even if it was dusty and cramped. Mahmoud saw a cardboard box of used toys at one of the shops and knelt to dig in it, while his mother and brother and sister walked on. He sifted through it, hoping, "Yes! A Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle!" It was the one with the red bandana. The box didn't have any other Ninja Turtles in it, but Walid would be excited to get it. Mahmoud hoped so, at least. Walid didn't seem to get excited about much these days. Mahmoud paid 10 Syrian pounds for it, about 5 cents in American money. A car honked behind Mahmoud, and he turned like everybody else. It was an old blue Opel taxi, traveling so slowly Mahmoud could walk faster. It was the only car Mahmoud had seen in the camp, and the crowd parted for it as it drew closer. A Syrian pop song blared from the radio, and young men and women danced and laughed alongside the taxi. As it passed, Mahmoud saw a young couple sitting in the back. The woman was dressed in a white satin dress and veil. It was a marriage procession, Mahmoud realized. Back in Syria, it was a tradition to be escorted to your wedding by a parade of cars to help carry you into your new life. Mahmoud remembered his uncle's wedding before the war. His uncle had worn a tuxedo, and his bride had worn a dress of sparkling jewels and a tiara, and they had been escorted by a dozen cars to a party where Mahmoud had eaten a piece of the delicious 7-tiered cake and danced with his mother to a real band. Here, the couple's only escort was a group of rowdy teenage boys running behind the taxi, and their destination was a dirty white tent with whatever food they'd been able to buy in the camp's market. But everyone seemed to be having fun. The old taxi's exhaust pipe made a sound like a gunshot, puck, and everybody ducked instinctively. The spell of happiness and safety was momentarily broken by the unforgettable memories of the chaos they had just escaped. Mahmoud's heart was still racing when someone put a hand on his shoulder and he jumped. It was his dad.
Mahmoud, where's your mother? Where are Walid and Hannah? His father asked. I found us a ride, but we have to leave now.
Joseph. Somewhere on the Atlantic Ocean, 1939. 10 days from home. Joseph followed the small group of kids through the raised doorway onto the bridge of the St. Louis. The bridge was a narrow, curving room that stretched from one side of the ship to the other. Bright sunlight streamed in through 24 windows, offering a panoramic view of the vast, blue-green Atlantic and wispy white clouds. Throughout the wood-decked room were metal benches with maps and rulers on them, and the walls were dotted with mysterious gauges and meters made of shining brass. There were a number of crewmen on the bridge, some of them wearing blue and white sailor uniforms like the stewards, and three more in brass-buttoned blue jackets with gold bands at the cuffs and blue officer's caps with gold trim. One of the regular sailors stood at a spoked steering wheel the size of a truck tire, with handles sticking out all around it. It looked like the steering wheels Joseph had seen in paintings of pirate ships, but this one was metal and connected to a big rectangular pedestal. The shortest of the three men in fancy uniforms strode over to the group with a big smile on his face. Joseph recognized him from the Shabbos service.
"Welcome to the bridge, boys and girls," he said. "I'm Captain Schroeder."
The captain shook each of their hands, even though none of them was older than 13. One of the parents on board the ship had arranged for a tour of the bridge and engine room for any children who wanted to attend, and 8 of them had signed up. Ruthie and Evelina hadn't been interested, but Renata was there, along with a few of the other older kids. Captain Schroeder introduced them to his first officer and the other crew on the bridge, and showed them what some of the gauges and dials meant. Joseph listened eagerly.
"This is the engine control for the St. Louis," Captain Schroeder explained. "When we want to change speed, we grip these handles, slide them all the way forward, and then pull them back to the new setting." He smiled. "I'm not going to change the speed now, because we've got the engines set right where we want them."
Joseph noticed both handles were set to ahead full.
"Are we going full speed because we're racing 2 other ships to Cuba?" Joseph asked.
The captain looked surprised, and then a little angry.
"Where did you hear that we're racing other ships to Cuba?" he asked Joseph.
"2 stewards were talking about it the other day," Joseph said, feeling a little nervous. "They said if we don't make it there first, they might not let us in."
The captain pursed his lips and glanced meaningfully at his first officer, who looked concerned. The captain turned on his smile again.
"We're not in any kind of race," he said, looking from Joseph to the other kids. "We're just making best possible speed because we have calm seas and a following wind. You've nothing to worry about. Now, perhaps Petty Officer Yockel will show you the engine room."
As high up as the bridge was on the ship, the engine room was just as far down. After stepping through a steel fire door that had "Crew Only" painted on it in big letters, Joseph and the tour group went down staircase after staircase, and they still weren't to the engine room yet. Below decks was very different from what Joseph was used to above decks. Where everything on A, B, and C decks was airy and comfortable, there were no portholes here, no spacious cabins. The air was damp and smelled of cigarettes and cabbage and sweat. Peeking into the rooms, Joseph could see that the crew quarters below decks had 2 beds to a room and barely enough space to turn around. The hallways were narrow and the ceilings were low. Petty Officer Yockel had to duck as they went through doorways. Joseph had never been afraid of tight places before, but the close living conditions made him uneasy. He felt like he was visiting an alien world. The 7 other kids must have felt the same way because they were all silent. Even Renata. From down the hall came the sound of men singing, and Petty Officer Yockel slowed. As they got closer, Joseph recognized the tune. It was the Horst Wessel song, the anthem of the Nazi party. Joseph's skin crawled, and he and the other kids looked at each other nervously. Joseph had heard the Horst Wessel song hundreds of times in the weeks following his father's abduction. It had gone overnight from an obscure song the Nazis sang at rallies to the unofficial national anthem of Germany. And it was frightening. The last time Joseph had heard the song was the day every one of his neighbors had lined the street to salute as Nazi soldiers marched by. Petty Officer Jockel tried to slip the children past the little common room where the crewmen were drinking and singing, but suddenly someone in the room called out,
"Stop! Passengers aren't allowed down here!"
Jockel froze, and so did Joseph. One of the men got up from the table, a scowl on his face. He was a thick-set man with a bulbous nose, bulldog cheeks, and dark, heavy eyebrows. Joseph knew that face from somewhere. Had he been their steward at dinner? Set up their beds one night? No. Joseph remembered. This was the man he had seen in the balcony the morning of the Shabbos service, the man who had been angry that the portrait of Hitler had been taken down and removed. The man staggered a little, bumping into things as he tried to move through the tight little room. Joseph had seen drunk people leaving pubs in Berlin the same way. "The captain has given these children special permission to visit the engine room, Schindick," Petty Officer Jockel told him. "The captain," Schindick said, his voice dripping with disapproval. Even from where Joseph stood, he could smell the alcohol on his breath. "Yes," Jockel said, straightening. "The captain." On the wall of the common room, Joseph saw a bulletin board with Nazi slogans and headlines from the rabidly anti-Jewish newspaper Der Stürmer pinned to it. He felt a shiver of fear. "Jewish rats," Schindick said, sneering at Joseph and the other kids. Many of them looked at their shoes, and even Joseph looked away, trying not to draw the big man's attention. Joseph clenched his fists, and his ears burned hot with frustration and embarrassment at his helplessness. After a few tense moments, Schindick staggered back to his seat, the threat of the captain's rank still worth something, even so far away from the bridge. Petty Officer Jockel hurried the children along, and Schindick and his friends broke into another Nazi song, even louder than before. Joseph heard them sing, "When Jewish blood flows from the knife, things will go much better," before Jockel ushered them down another flight of stairs. Joseph's legs felt weak, and he clung to the railing. He thought they had escaped all this on the St. Louis, but the hatred had followed them even here, to the middle of the ocean. With its huge diesel engines and generators and dials and pumps and switches, the engine room should have been fascinating, but Joseph had a hard time getting excited about it. None of the other children were excited either. Not after what had happened with Schindick. The tour ended solemnly, and Petty Officer Jockel returned them to the surface, being careful to take them back by a different route. It was a different world below decks, Joseph thought. A world outside the magic little bubble he and the other Jews lived in, above decks, on the MS St. Louis. Here, below decks, was the real world.
Isabel. The Straits of Florida, somewhere north of Cuba. 1994. One day from home. Isabel watched as Papi, Señor Castillo, Luis, and Amara huddled over the boat engine, trying to figure out why it wouldn't start. It had something to do with it overheating, Señor Castillo had said. Amara was pouring seawater over it, trying to cool it. Meanwhile, Iván and Isabel had been tasked with scooping the water back out of the bottom of the boat. The sock stuffed into the bullet hole was soaked through, and it drip, drip, dripped water onto Castro's face at the bottom of the boat like a leaky faucet. They had been drifting north in the Gulf Stream with the motor silent for more than an hour now, and no one was singing or dancing or laughing anymore. Ahead of Isabel, her mother and Señora Castillo slept against each other on the narrow bench at the front of the boat, where the prow came to a point. Lito sat on the middle bench, right above Isabel and Iván.
"You do have family in Miami," Isabel's grandfather told her, as she and Iván worked. "When that news lady asked you if you had family in El Norte, you said no, but you do," Lito said. "My brother, Guillermo."
Isabel and Ivan looked up at each other in surprise.
I didn't know you had a brother, Isabel said to her grandfather.
He left in the airlifts in the 1970s. The Freedom Flights, when the U.S. airlifted political dissidents off the island,
Lito explained.
But Guillermo was no dissident. He just wanted to live in the U.S. I could have gone too. I was a police officer once, like Luis and Amara. Did you know that? Back before Castro, when Batista was president.
Isabel knew that, and that Lito had lost his job during the revolution and been sent to cut cane in the fields instead.
I could have pulled strings, Lito said, called in favors, gotten me and your grandmother off the island.
Then you would have been born in El Norte, Ivan told Isabel.
She paused in her scooping, thinking how different her life might be right now. Born in the United States. It was almost inconceivable.
We stayed because Cuba was our home, Lito said. I didn't leave when Castro took over in 1959. I didn't leave when the U.S. sent planes in the 70s. And I didn't leave in the 80s when all those people sailed out of Mariel Harbor.
Lito shook his head at the tight cluster of people worrying over the engine at the back of the boat and thumped his fist against the side.
It was a mistake leaving on this sinking coffin. I should have stayed put. All of us should have. How is Cuba worse now than it ever was? We've always been beholden to somebody else. First it was Spain, then it was the U.S., then it was Russia. First Batista, then Castro. We should have waited. Things change. They always change.
But do they ever get better? Ivan asked.
Isabel thought that was a good question. All her life, things had only gotten worse. First the Soviet Union collapsing, then her parents fighting, then her father trying to leave, then her grandmother dying. She waited for Lito to tell her different, to tell her that things would get better. Isabel and Ivan shared a glance. Lito's silence was answer enough.
Someone would have done something, Lito said at last. We should have waited.
But they were going to arrest Papi, said Isabel.
I know you love your father, Chabela, but he's a fool.
Isabel's cheeks burned hot with anger and embarrassment. She loved Lito, but she loved her Papi too, and she hated to hear Lito say bad things about him. But even worse, he was saying these things in front of her best friend. She glanced quickly at Ivan. He kept his eyes on his work, pretending not to have heard. But they were right at Lito's feet. He could hear everything. And Lito wasn't finished.
He's risking his life for this. He's risking your life, and your mother's life, and his unborn child's life. And for what?
Lito asked.
He doesn't even know. He can't say. Ask him why he wants to go to the States, and all he can say is freedom. That's not a plan. How is he going to put a roof over your head and food on your table any better than he did in Cuba?
Lito raised his eyebrows at Isabel.
He's taking you away from who you are. What you are. How are you ever going to learn to count clave in Miami? The U.S. has no soul. In Havana, you would have learned it without even trying. Clave is the hidden heartbeat of the people, beneath whatever song Batista or Castro is playing.
Oh, hush, Papi,
Isabel's mother said sleepily. She had been awake enough to hear them after all, at least the last part.
Miami is just North Cuba.
Mommy shifted and went back to sleep. But Isabel worried that Lito was right. She had never been able to count clave, but she had always assumed it would come to her eventually. that the rhythm of her homeland would one day whisper its secrets to her soul. But would she ever hear it now? Like trading her